Mommy has a reward for you.
Jason, Mother is talking to you!
Jason, Mother is talking to you.
That's my boy.
Come, kneel down. That's a
I know what you're thinking. Where the hell was I, right? Friday the 13th was almost 2 weeks ago at this point. I know. And yes, you've come to expect more at this point. I am the master of timing. I know that. God, I really nail those dates. Everything's important. A review would come out the day after the movie hit theaters and all that good stuff, even on retros and holiday thing. Yeah, I know. I'm one of the best that ever did it. I know. But this episode just wasn't planned that way. So yeah, you're reading the title right. This is about Sackhead, the definitive Friday the 13th Part 2 retrospective. That is a book that hit Amazon.com on Friday the 13th or the 11th, something like that. By my good buddy Ron Gann, we became buds because of Friday the 13th Part 2. I kind of forgot how he approached me or I approached him. I'm not really sure. Maybe he heard Skeleton Crew stuff and heard my passion. I kind of forgot the origins of how we started talking. But yeah, I'm buddies with the author of this book. He is really good acquaintances with the entire cast of Friday the 13th Part 2. He does the handling at the shows and stuff like that, so he hangs with these people all the time. I mean, besides me, this is the right guy to write this book. And actually, he's even better than I would be at writing the book, because I've been reading it, and yeah, I would have missed some of this stuff. The way he paints the picture, the way he sets up where he's going, I mean, these are all alley-oops and slam dunks all along the way. He goes back and brings the characters to life. I'm not done with the book, but I am currently actively reading it. I read about 3 chapters today at work. Oh, I mean, I was working. And when I got home, I read them. Anyway, good to be back in this chair. Great to be talking about my favorite horror movie of all time. Remember, it always bounced around between Psycho 3 and Friday 2, but in the grand scheme of things, Friday 2 has to win. It's my favorite franchise. It's the movie I was watching since I was 11 years old. A few of you might know the story. Those summer nights, VHS tape copied from Palmer Video. It's the only one I owned. And as I grew up and I had some distance between these movies, I popped that one in along with all the rest of them. And it just stuck out to me as, damn, I was watching the best one this whole time. How about that? And I always thought it was weird that mine didn't have a hockey mascot, which we all know is the only reason it's not considered the best. But at any rate, let's waste no time. I'm going to play a little special thing I made for the Banana Laser Friday 2 review, that the gigantic review that we did. Me, Matt, and Dave, we all realized that Friday 2 is like our favorite one, and we felt it deserved a special. It was like a big Friday 13th Part 2 extravaganza, if you remember that. We had that huge review, we had the video commentary that we did live with all 3 of us in the same room. Great stuff. But tonight, you're going to get a treat. I'm going to talk with this guy about his book. It's going to be great, fun time, and you'll see if it sounds like something you want to pick up or not. I would. That's my recommendation already, but doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to this interview. It's going to be a good time. And it's just good to be back. Like I said, I guess I'm breaking the 10-year rule, 2023. I didn't think I would do a show. I thought I was going to I thought I was going to have my ties severed clean. Yeah, I thought that was going to be me, but I guess my ties are not severed clean with the skeleton crew. I'm going into season 11, I guess, right? I'm tied to this mic. No, I want to be here. I wouldn't do it if I didn't want to. So here we go. Enjoy the review, and happy belated.
Jeff.
What?
You ready?
For what?
Camp Blood.
We're not supposed to go near that place.
Oh, come on. It's only a short walk. They'll never know we're gone. Jeff, I'm serious. I really want to see it. Look, when we get back to the city, we can tell everyone we were there. Oh, come on, you chicken shit.
I told the others. They didn't believe me. You're all doomed. You're all doomed.
Welcome to God's country.
Scott. Hi, good to see you here, buddy. You need it.
You're too close. Things have been quiet for 5 years, and that's the way we want to keep it.
What if there is a Jason?
Oh, bullshit. Jenny?
No, what if there is some kind of boy or beast running around Camp Crystal Lake?
Paul, there's someone in this fucking room!
Jason's out there.
They wouldn't do anything like this.
What do you think?
I think you're drunk.
I'll take care of that. Hit us again, sweetheart.
And keep clean during your messes, sir.
Damn that Paul, him and his wilderness bullshit!
What the hell?
These kids smell better job than I do.
Jason, Mother is talking to you.
Well, what would it be like today? Some kind of out-of-control psychopath? A frightened retard? A child trapped in a man's body?
I don't want to scare anyone, but I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason.
Asshole, this is my truck!
No seconds on dessert for Jeff and Sandra tonight.
Are you sure you don't want me to clear those?
No, I'm collecting these.
Have it your way, honey. I just don't want the bar to fall down on you.
It's more fun using that child psychology on you. You're such a sucker, Warren.
I don't intend to be in this thing the rest of my life.
Terry, you turkey.
Are there any after-hours places to live in?
Sure are.
Up whole camp. We'll find our own cabin.
His body was never recovered from the lake after he drowned.
Thanks, Mike. You've done your job well, and Mommy is pleased.
Jason's a legend. A legend, 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 legend.
I am here with Ron H. Gann, the author of Sackhead, the definitive retrospective on Friday the 13th. Part 2. What's up, Ron?
I am. Look at me, Mom. I'm on top of the world. Skeleton crew.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's great having you on. For those of you who don't know, me and Ron became buddies like, I'd say, roughly 5 years ago or so. Time flies, so I don't know. It could have been a little less, a little more. And it's because of our love for Friday the 13th, Part 2. He you know, heard some Skeleton Crew shows, heard Banana Laser. I kind of help him run the Friday the 13th Part 2 Packanack. What's it called exactly on Facebook, the group?
Packanack Lodge.
Okay, it's easy. I thought there was more to it for some reason. Yeah, so...
Well, there is in writing. Okay, Packanack Lodge, Friday the 13th Part 2, 1981.
Right? Ah, there you go. That was the confusing part.
Right.
So I'm like a moderator with you there. So that's an honor in itself. It's a great group. You should join it. So who better to write this book? I mean, I never saw anyone who is as into this movie as me. Like, you're really the only other person. And I guess now you taught me, because you wrote this book, The Definitive Retrospective. It's a full book. It's not like you barely had anything to say. There's clearly, it's a thick book. It's a good read. It's a fleshed out. I mean, you probably got everything out that you wanted to. I'm sure you went over it 50 times before you released it. Tell us, how did you come to write this Friday the 13th Part 2 retrospective book?
Well, first of all, you and I have known each other since 2020, about 3 years, going on 3 years, 2.5 years, something like that. So don't make me older than I am.
it's been seven years, I thought.
Right. And I am actually, I just want to say thanks for having me on your podcast, because I'm a fan of the podcast in general and of you in particular, because as you alluded to earlier, I don't know a lot of people who share my passion for the first sequel in the Friday the 13th franchise as much as you do, and who is an apologist and an ambassador for the film. And so I immediately sensed and felt a camaraderie with you, even though it was through online social platforms without having ever met before up and until New Jersey. So it's a pleasure to be here. I've done podcasts before for this book. I've got more podcasts lined up, but this is the one that I've been excited to do, because I know that and you'll forgive me for putting it this way, I'm with some bedfellows right now. And that is, I'm with somebody who I can get in bed with in terms of this movie and passion and zeal. And don't sell yourself short. You're going to read the 277-page book, and I have a feeling you're going to know most of it like the back of your hand. I may remind you of a few things,
right. But
I think you're quite the scholar yourself, right. So you've been an inspiration for me. So having said that, one of the reasons I was drawn to write this book, without boring you or your audience more than I probably already have, is that I'm a creative guy. I like to do creative things. I build dioramas, so forth and so on, and usually in the horror genre. And I just wanted to do something creative about this particular movie. I had built dioramas. I did Sackhead Jason's shack. I'm working on Packanack Lodge in terms of model building, just for kicks and giggles. But I fancy myself a writer, Alex. And so I have actually written some other books, academic books that would bore everybody to death if I told you about them. And so because I fancy myself a writer and kind of enjoy it, from a creative standpoint, I thought I would combine my two loves, because also I could not find, and I don't think there is any treatment on this movie in print anywhere. You'll find a smorgasbord of material on the franchise, part two being included, but nothing exclusive to part two. So that was one of the reasons. A, I wanted to do something creative and conjoin my two loves of Friday the 13th part two in writing. And then thirdly, because I think the market needs it. I'm 52 years old, and I'm very nostalgic as I've gotten older. And that was another driving force. And you know, and I know that new movies are going to come down the pike, and these original movies will be, I won't say forgotten. They'll be considered classics of the golden age, but I just wanted to give them a voice in print. So I researched the movie for about 2 years, by way of Packanack Lodge, the group, Facebook group, not with the intention of writing a book, but just wanting to know more and more about the movie as I grew in my fandom. And then I just decided I should flesh that out in print for the series fans such as yourself. So the genesis behind the book is just my creative arc and my passion for the movie, wanting to evangelize it. That's it. I wanted to evangelize it.
Okay. So your background on this movie, I assume you saw it in theaters in 1981?
I was 11 years old. I did not get to see it, and that's another reason that was an impetus behind the book. So I'm 11 years old when this movie comes out. I don't know what your median age is for your listening audience, but in 1981, there was a thing called Showtime and HBO, and it came in a cable box. And that box could actually be locked by key by your parents. Mm. All right? And so I'm staying the night at my friend's house, and the reason I'm sharing this story is not to be long-winded, but it also plays into why I wrote the book.
Hey, I asked you.
Okay. All right. I'm staying the night at my buddy's house, my best friend from childhood, as was our custom, his dad worked graveyard shift. I'm from Seattle originally, so he worked at Boeing. And we had, basically, it was me and my brother, along with my best friend and his older brother, the four of us. We had the house to ourselves, and of course, what are four kids going to do? We're going to try to watch dirty movies or whatever we can on cable TV. And we broke into his dad's room, single parent. So we broke into his dad's room and we found the key to the cable box. We unlocked the cable box. We had no idea what was on, except there was this movie that was new to cable. The year is 1982. So it was new to cable, and it was called Friday the 13th Part 2. And so we were like, oh, these are scary movies. We've heard about this. Let's watch it. So we watched it, and we thought that we were under the protective covering of our sleeping bags, and we weren't. And it was crazy. So it was whenever I see the movie, it takes me back to that summer night in 1982, watching a movie from 1981 with my four friends, being young, having, you know, and so that, there's the nostalgia left. So I saw it for the first time as a 12-year-old on cable. I was too young to see it in the theater.
Right.
So I'm not that old, man.
Well, hey, so my parents brought me to see things. I was in 1989. I was 10, and I saw Friday 13th Part 8 in theater.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
Why I asked you. I figured maybe your dad got you into, you know, like just, you know, it's to me, that's nothing. My parents back then weren't as protective as they are now. They didn't.
Absolutely. Totally different. I will share with you this. The year is 1984, and I think it was Rocky III I went to go see, and we all snuck in instead to go see the final chapter.
Well, right. We went to see Batman that day, and then as we left the theater, we saw that it was Friday the 13th Part 8. My dad goes, come on, and he just walks us in there.
So those are how you make memories, man.
Yeah, we have a lot of parallel memories in that way.
I guess so, man. I guess so. So.
And the other one is that I think, discovered this movie when I was 11 years old in 1990 or 91.
Yeah.
It was a summer night because my parents were upstairs sleeping. I was home from school all summer, and I snuck into the VHS drawer or whatever, and I saw Friday 13th. I knew it was a bad thing. I was like, wow, this is cool. And for some reason, that's the only one my dad he used to copy tapes from the video store, and that's the only one we had. And I put it in, and I just remember those late, like, cool summer nights with all the windows open, like, watching this when everyone's sleeping. And I was completely just blown away, and I just kept watching it. I remember that. And then as I grew up, it was just the clear favorite. So I assume this is your absolute favorite Friday the 13th as well.
It is. It's my favorite. So this is how I classify him. And I think you and I have talked about this before, at least in messaging. So I'll probably get some eggs thrown at me by some of your listeners. But I'm a fan of slasher Jason. Okay. So I am not a fan of zombie Jason, demon Jason, fake Jason, or space Jason. Right.
Right, same with me. I say it all the time.
Okay, so I acknowledge the first four Friday the 13th. And so in doing so, I label the first one the classic, the second one the favorite, the third one the iconic, and of course the fourth one, and here's the controversy, the fourth one is probably the best one. It's the quintessential.
In a technical way, right, yeah.
Absolutely. You could see it there. But part two, yeah, it is my favorite. And I'll tell you why it's my favorite. I absolutely appreciate the cast of characters. I'm not talking just the actors. I'm talking about the characters. They're likable characters performed by likable actors. I'm attracted to a humanistic Jason who's vulnerable,
right,
yet intimidating, powerful, yet mortal. And somebody who could really happen. Yeah. So part two will always be my favorite. And I have a side note to tell you. Bill Randolph wrote the foreword to the book.
Yes.
He played, for your listeners who don't know, he played Jeff in part two, who happens to be my favorite character in the entire series. And when Bill Randolph was reading the book in its first draft form from cover to cover, and kind of cross-checking this, that, proof-checking this, he put the movie in, and he watched it from soup to nuts, beginning to end. He does that once a year.
Okay.
And he calls me up, and he says, you know, that's a damn good movie. And I said, you're darn right it's a good movie, man. And so it's just a good movie. It's well-directed. It's decently written. And it's well-performed. And it's got an incredible final girl and an incredible humanistic antagonist. And that's why it's my favorite. And I'm sure that's probably – how about you? Is that – what makes it your favorite?
It's just – it has everything. Like you said, the cast – the characters. One thing that really strikes me is the reoccurring, well, not that they do it a bunch, but just with these two movies, characters having Crazy Ralph come in.
Yeah.
And having the flashback from the last movie. I used to hate that. I actually used to forward that all the time growing up. Because, like, yeah.
I remember you saying that on your podcast. I remember you saying that. Go ahead.
Right. But now, and especially when I'm showing it to people for the first time, I don't expect them to watch both movies, but I want them to watch this one. So I just leave it. And, obviously, so they know the backstory. But that, not only having Adrian King come back in the beginning, that really solidifies it, but the ultimate solidification, the ultimate stamp of approval is Betsy Palmer back at the end to say, Jason, now your mother's talking to you. And like all that right there makes this movie 100% legit. And it really just feels special at that moment. Actually, the whole moment, but the gore, as we all know now, the uncut scenes we've all seen is amazing.
Incredible stuff. Incredible.
I only wish we could splice that back in. I would even take a crappy version spliced in. You know, I don't even care, as long as I can see it on some level. Then you got, like, the jump scares. There's, like, four or five jump scares, and they
incredible jump scares.
Work.
Outstanding.
Work, right. Like you said, the humanistic side of Jason. He seems like a wild dude in the wilderness. Just the way he looks, the way he runs, the way he acts, the way he behaves in every situation, even the way he was scared of that chainsaw, everything. Mm-hmm. It's just so spot on. There's really no flubs here. The music is
That's amazing. Where I wanted to go next. That's exactly right, yeah.
Just great. The atmosphere, when they shot it, the time of year they shot it, the fact that people are actually wearing shorts and bikinis and not like part six where they're in like winter coats. Like, it just feels like what it really is supposed to be. And it's just, everything's right about it. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I got to second that. I got some inside baseball I'll share with you as it relates to when they filmed the movie. So if you go to IMDb or even listen to some cast interviews, the common knowledge is that they shot the film from the first week of October into the middle of November, which logically is after the camp season. So they had the camp to themselves to do the filming, right? And so I just ran with that. I just considered that to be common knowledge, and I put that in my book. So Bill's reading it, and it wasn't sitting right. That plane did not land well for him. And he calls me up, and he said, hey, I think your dates are wrong. I go, well, if my dates are wrong, then the internet's wrong, and the internet's never wrong. And he said, he goes, well, guess what I did? And I go, tell me. He goes, I found my tax returns from 1980, because they filmed in 80. And he actually had the exact dates, his pay stubs, the dollar amount for 5 weeks that he was on set. And filming started September 4th. So it was still nice out. Still warm out.
Oh, yeah.
And it shot through the middle of October, which is why you can also see Amy Steele's breath at night, especially in the climax of the movie. But and getting back to your point about the humanistic Jason, you know, also the location, how it feels. It's got that connective tissue to the first one. It's my biggest gripe with part three. I mean, in part two, Jason is, according to Steve Dash's measurements, 5'11", 175 pounds, right?
Right.
And of course, in part three, he's 6'3", 225 pounds. So there's a massive continuity issue. And of course, the location where they shot part three in California drives me nuts. You can see the desert mountains in the background. And it just kind of lost some of that connective tissue that part two not only holds on to, but champions,
yeah.
including the fade to white.
Right.
And see, you know, so, yeah, I see part one and part two as almost a seamless movie combined. And by the way, getting back to your point about the returning cast of characters, I write in the book about particularly Crazy Ralph and how Steve Miner, the director, was insistent that Gurney return.
Wow.
Because he wanted to maintain that connective tissue. He also had a lot of respect for Walt Gurney as a theater actor. He wanted to have some sort of DNA with part one. And that was also another reason why they brought back Adrian King, which I do write about in the book at length in her chapter, was not a good experience.
A pleasant, yeah, I know. I interviewed her and she told us all about it. Like, they didn't even get her clothes that fit. Like, she hated it. And it was all improv. Yeah, it's crazy. But just the way it all connects. Yeah, it's definitely it's also a strange movie because, as they talked about in the classroom discussion in Scream 2, this, and people will probably say we're crazy, whatever, but this is a sequel that tops the original for me. Now, listen, I know it's not Savini and all that good stuff, but that's not all that makes a movie to me. You know, it takes a lot more, and I don't know, this cast and the way it was shot and the writing, for sure, I felt is much stronger in part two. I actually never was a fan of the writing in part one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was like a ton of throwaway stuff. But there are great moments and great shots and things like that. But I just felt like they took what they just, you know, hurried up and copied Halloween with and did their thing. And they said, okay, how could we do this and just do, you know, shine this up a little bit and put it out there again in a, you know, a fresher way or whatever, and a better way. And I think they did improve on it. So that's just my opinion. I'm sure you can't mess with the greats. So
let me say this. Let me just back you up to your point. Do you know how many off-screen kills part one had?
I know three.
I think it's four or five.
Really?
See, the kills that you really see are Jack, Kevin Bacon's character, Marcy. You get to see the axe to the head, right? You don't see Annie. Oh, yeah, you see Annie, and you see her kills. You don't see Brenda's kill. You don't see Ned's kill.
Right.
Who else?
Steve Christie.
Yeah, you don't see Steve Christie's kill. We could go through the litany. I think that there might be one or two more. I could be mistaken, but the off-screen kills are inordinate.
Oh, Bill, you don't really see.
That's exactly right. What you see in part one, outside of Kevin Bacon's character and Marcy, or Jack and Marcy, you see the after effects. Do you know how many off-screen kills there are in part two?
One.
That's it.
Right.
Yeah, Terry, right?
Yep.
And that's it. And I don't like that. I mean, I don't like that part one had so many off-screen kills. Part two, it was full frontal. It came right at you. And by the way, Carl Fulton, you know, he's no stepson. I mean, he can hold his own to Tom Savini. I saw that final cut, or those uncut kills. The guy was phenomenal. I mean, he studied under Dick Smith, who is the renowned makeup artist in Hollywood, created the Wolfman and all that stuff. Yeah, he was no chump. So
yeah, he was no slouch. I thought he was really good. I didn't see anything lacking in any of these uncut kills.
You know, if I were to pick on one thing about part two, I have a hard time. I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, I know it's not a perfect movie. I think the one thing that I have a problem with is I think Miner overdoes it on the POV shots, and they're disingenuous. You think it's Jason's point of view and Terry's looking straight at you, and it's not. And then Jenny's looking straight at you from her cabin,
right,
but it's not really Jason's point. That's a little disingenuous and a little misleading. I thought that he abused the POV shot that was originated in Halloween, and then part one, or Friday part one, picked up on. And I thought he did use it a little too much in part two. That's really my only nip.
He didn't use it to compliment or improve or add to the experience. He used it as like strange, misleading, weird.
Exactly.
No point to moments. Yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah.
And I told Russell Todd this. He played, for your listeners, he played Scott in part two. He's the guy that was lassoed upside down and had his throat cut. I think that the way in which his kill is set up is a little far-fetched. The way that he has 2 feet landed straight in that small lasso.
That too, right.
You know, backing up in the middle of the night in the woods was a little far-fetched. That's really my only complaints. Other than that, I think that's a perfect slasher flick, man. I really do, too.
Yeah. Why write on just one movie that's in a 40-year-old franchise that has a dozen? I mean, I guess the answer is just because it's your favorite. I mean, that's a simple answer. Or you just felt, like you said, you wanted something in print.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. The simple answer is, and we've already addressed it a little bit, is nostalgia purposes, what the movie meant to me personally. It is my favorite, so... And there's nothing in print about it. And I wanted to just really evangelize, promote, spread the quality of this movie. I don't want it to get lumped in with Jason Goes to Hell. I don't want it to get lumped in with Freddy vs. I don't, man.
I hate that it's not recognized as one of the greatest ever. Like, it's weird. People don't... See, here's the thing. I always felt like, you know, Halloween is the first of Michael. It's always the greatest. You know, Texas Chainsaw is the first Leatherface, the first Freddy movie. This is the first Jason movie, and Jason's arguably the biggest of all of these people. Why is this movie not seen? Why is it not held in the same regard? It's really, it's not like it's a lower quality movie than any of these other ones. I mean,
I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to answer that question because I do address this in the book. I don't address it at length. And I'm a huge fan of Steve Miner, but the blame has to go to his footstool or lay it at his feet, because he and the producers decided to rid themselves of continuity in part three. And so part two is dismissed because it doesn't have the hockey mask. I mean, that's really what you're talking about.
That's really it, right, yeah.
You're talking about an average-sized killer who's not a monster, but is actually, you know. And so part three, you get the more intense. Hey, look, when I have nightmares about Jason chasing me, and I do have those nightmares from time to time, no lie, it's always Richard Brooker who's after me. He is a bad Jason. I get it. I'm totally on board that. But that cheapens part two. They ran away, and I write about this in the book. They ran away from the stigma of the sack mask because of the critical lampooning that was thrown at the movie when it came out, because the year before, a movie came out starring Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt called The Elephant Man.
Right.
And that movie was famous for the Elephant Man, Richard Merrick, wearing a sack over his head. And so the movie was lampooned by critics, not just because it was a slasher, but because they thought that they were riding on the coattails of the Elephant Man. And so in part three, the producers ran away from that. Now, part two gets cheapened a little bit. It's dismissed in the eyes of some because of a more normal hillbilly Jason that doesn't land for some people. I disagree with that, by the way, but that's my personal opinion. And just to give you an example, the very first person to play Jason, I'm sorry, his name escapes. Thank you. What's his last name? It's just
Lehman.
Thank you. I wanted to say Lyman, but Ari Lehman. So I'm in Blairstown, 2019. It's the grand opening of the Friday the 13th Museum.
Okay.
CJ Graham's there, Ari Lehman's there, and I'm actually cosplaying as Sackhead Jason. And Ari Lehman comes up to me and very affectionately puts his arm around me, welcomes me to the, because, you know, I'm donning the goods. And he says to me, "You, Sackhead, I consider him Jason's little brother." That's what he said, you know? And so that's why the movie gets dismissed, because you have people out there with that kind of perception. That's not a shot at Ari. He's entitled to his opinion, and many people share it. But I think it boils down to a more humanistic, hillbilly, sack-wearing Jason that is not the iconic hockey goalie mask Jason that people have come to know, and that's why the movie's dismissed. That's my long-winded answer.
No,
sorry.
That's the answer we all need to hear, because let's face it, that's the truth, right? I mean, there is nothing lacking in this movie but a hockey mask. And I gotta say, I was always a fan of the fact that he didn't have a hockey mask, because as I got, well, when I was younger, and I learned more about Jason, and I was like, then I always went back, because remember, I didn't have the money or the means to gather more of these movies, so I would just have to wait for them on HBO or whatever, or watch them at my cousin's house. So I always thought, gee, how come, like, the Jason movie I have, he doesn't have a hockey mask? And then as I watched the other ones and I went back home and everything and I went back to my tape, I was like, you know, this is kind of cool though, because it's like, this is like Jason before he was this big famous guy, like back when it was like real, like his origins. Like,
yep.
I love that fact that there's like an evolution to him. It adds so much to the lore, and it's incredible. I mean, it's really, it heightens what this already was before the sequels came out.
I couldn't agree with you more. So obviously, the accusations made laid at the footstool of the producers is that when concocting their formulaic sequel, they ripped off The Town That Dreaded Sundown from 1974 in designing the look of their killer. The producers protest that. I do think that they were probably influenced by it, but they protested that and they said, no, we were trying to be authentic to a 33-year-old man living in the woods, having been there for 23 of those years by himself, and how he would acquire his outfit. And it seemed logical that he would acquire a countryish look to include a simple sack over his head. And that's the official answer. And I like that. It's a lot more authentic than a hockey goalie mask, which I do like, by the way. I do like. It's just not very conducive to a killer.
It's not what he would find in the woods alone. Yeah. But it works with how he found it in part three. So that it's okay.
And I do address it in the ask and answered question in the book as to why Jason's appearance changed so drastically in part three. And without showing my hand, I will give a hint and say there is a legitimate narrative explanation in as much as there's also a behind the scenes explanation. And I've already alluded to the behind the scenes where the producers wanted to get away from the ridicule that they had from part two about the Elephant Man. But there is a narrative explanation that has to do with the killer on the lam trying to change his appearance, blah, blah, blah. But the readers can check that out for themselves and see if they buy it or not. So.
Well, speaking of that, since you alluded to a couple of things that you did write about, if you were going to sell this whole book and idea to somebody, what would you say that a Friday the 13th part two fan can expect in an overall way from this book?
Okay. All right. I appreciate that question. Hopefully I can answer it intelligently. I treat Friday the 13th part two. I approach it from a high-minded approach. In other words, I don't treat it like a slasher flick made in 1981 for blood and gore or splatter flick. I actually treat it as canon. And I approach it from a scholarly or from a scholastic standpoint, which is why I take the movie too seriously. And I'm defending narrative questions and this, that, or the other thing. I think the serious fan of the Friday the 13th franchise in general, and part two in particular, will appreciate the scholarship that I put into the book in legitimizing not only the story, but also the final product, the movie. There's a reason why Bill Randolph said it's a pretty damn good movie, right? Mm-hmm. And I try to put some impetus behind that from a scholastic and scholarly standpoint, though I'm not a scholar. I'm just a buff, a fan buff, a movie buff.
Right.
So I think that's one thing that they will appreciate. The other thing is I treat the material, I'm being a little redundant here, but I treat the material, the actors, the making of the movie, all the nuances that go into it, I treat it with respect because I think it warrants it. And Friday the 13th Part 2 took itself very seriously.
Right.
And I want to take it seriously. Even 43 years later, 42 years later, after its initial release, the movie still holds up because it took itself seriously. You can't say that about Jason Takes Manhattan. You can't say that about Jason Goes to Hell. You can't say that about Freddy versus Jason and all that stuff. But you can say that about part two. I think you can say that about the first four. So I think the serious fan will appreciate that. I think that bleeds, forgive the pun. I think that bleeds on every page.
Okay. So is this what is this book? Is it a retrospective of part two, like the way we did it on Banana Laser? Is it like a salacious and gossipy type thing? Or is it more like an encyclopedia? I know you're not just, but are you putting in a lot of facts and things like that? What was the approach kind of?
So let me just disarm your listeners right now and say, this is not an encyclopedia. This is not a reference book. I wrote it to be entertaining. I wrote it to be informative. I wrote it to be scholastic. And I wrote it to be a puff piece. In other words, to celebrate the movie. So this is what the reader can expect. This is what you can expect when you crack it. After the first couple of chapters that lays the foundation, what you're going to get is a chapter devoted to every single character in the book, to include Officer Deputy Winslow and Crazy Ralph, all the way to Mark Jarvis and Jeff and Marta, Sandra, and so forth. And in each chapter, it starts with a retelling of that particular character's story in narrative form. So it's entertaining. And I actually think that it's engrossing. It grabs the reader and brings them into the dramatics and legitimizes the character and up until their death, which I describe in detail. And I dedicate half the chapter to just actually analyzing the character. Then I transition to interviewing the actor who played that character.
Wow.
And what drove them to the character, their audition process, their experience making the movie, their insecurities, their likes, their joys, what they loved about it, what they hated about it, so forth, and where they're at today, so forth and so on. And then I end the chapter with an ask and answered section, sometimes specific to that character that I'm writing about, and sometimes going beyond that. So each chapter consists of a character analysis written in dramatic form that's not boring. It's a story. And then it transitions to a biography, or interview, excuse me, of the actor, and then it ends with an ask and answer. That's the blueprint. And overall, if I were to describe the book, I would describe it as a puff piece.
Wow.
It's meant to celebrate the movie. It's not meant to be salacious, although I have to admit one thing. If you are a fan of Friday the 13th Part 2, you know that behind the scenes, there are some salacious things that need to be dealt with. If you're going to write a retrospective.
This is probably the biggest of the franchise, actually, when it except for Freddy vs. Jason, which eventually became a whole thing.
Right. And so I spend a lot of time on Warrington Gillette and Steve Dash. Right? And I did not meet Steve Dash. I know that you had the privilege to meet him, Alex.
Oh, I had dinner with him, yeah. Sadly, this summer before he died, yeah.
And I will forever be envious of you for that. I have gotten to know Warrington Gillette. We are friendly. We converse face-to-face. He wants to work out with me. I'm a muscle head. we talk online, too. I'm not gonna put all my cards on the table, but if for those who don't know who are listening, both men played Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. There has been a long-standing controversy between the two men over who played Jason when, where, and for how long. And I deal with that subject, and there's no way but being a little bit salacious because one of the individuals is not actually on the up and up in terms of full disclosure.
Huh.
And there's a lot of embellishments. I don't think any one of the actors were duplicitous purposely or deceitful. I think that it's been 40 years and they started misremembering things.
Right.
Hey, look, man, you tell a story long enough, you start to believe.
It happens.
And there's a little bit of that. So that's the only salacious part that I deal with. That's in chapter 3. Where I deal with the character of Jason. Of course, I interviewed Warrington Gillette. I know Warrington Gillette. I didn't interview him directly for the book, but I relied on other interviews, so forth and so on. And you have to turn over that rock if you're going to do a retrospective on Part 2, because it is the one controversial thing that plagued, and I would even say continues to plague, the movie. Even though I do believe Steve Dash was able to, I guess I'm showing my hand already. How do I say this without trying to? I tend to lean towards the Steve Dash side of the argument, okay? And in the latter years of his life, the last 15 years of his life, there was a lot of wrongs that were righted.
I think it's been righted, yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm curious how you handle the, because I know Lauren Marie Taylor says Warrington is her Jason, so
yeah.
She remembers something that most people don't. And I'm curious but I don't want you to say, you know, that's part of why we're reading. And the other thing I'm curious about is as far as like the character bios, like I want to see what lengths you went to discuss Terry's death.
Like, that's great. You know, it's funny because the actress actually has her own interpretation of the death.
Wow.
He actually thinks she's still alive. That's what Kirsten Baker thinks.
Wait, even though she realizes, no, she must know that she's laying next to the...
But she will tell you, and there's some room here for disagreement. She will tell you that you won't see any blood on Terry.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, if you, like, zoomed in on this and try to find the most minuscule drop of blood and said, okay, so she was stabbed in the stomach or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I have not, but I have heard others, and I actually quote them in the book, who say that, who have a high-definition TV, who are able to zoom in and say that you can see blood on her forehead, that she was bludgeoned.
Okay.
I have not tried to duplicate that experiment. The truth of the matter is, if you look at the screenplay and you talk to the principal filmmakers, the chick is dead, right? You're talking about an actress that wants to come back for a sequel.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I made Lauren Marie Taylor come back.
Right?
Like,
yeah.
She was stabbed, I guess, but did, you know, sometimes people live.
I always thought about that when I watched your movie. I thought that was great. Yeah. I will say this about Lauren Marie Taylor, and you know, she and I are going to be talking tomorrow, and I've come to really just absolutely adore her. And I'm familiar with her quote that Warrington Gillette was her Jason. And I don't deny that, because I think that Warrington Gillette and Lauren Marie Taylor were good friends and maintained or retained their friendship for years. I will talk to her about it tomorrow, because I can document who played Jason for what kill, for what scenes. And I'm pretty sure I know what scenes Warrington Gillette played Jason in. And it's really just the climax of the movie, the window crash scene, and Crazy Ralph's kill, which, by the way, Warrington doesn't even really remember all that. and he did a couple of ancillary shots of his hands or his feet. Otherwise, it's Steve Dash all the way, with the exception of the killing of Jeff and Sandra, and that was exactly. And I fleshed that out in the book, so I don't know what Lauren Marie Taylor. I think that she really means that he was the guy that was on set with me
when they all just first started. That's what she recalls the most when it started.
That's my point.
Yeah,
that's my point. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And I always thought the dude holding the knife to kill her, he was like left handed, and that proved that was also maybe somebody else. I don't even remember. That's vague to me, but
yeah, it is a left. It's definitely a left-handed kill. But it's Jeff. It's Jerry Wallace from Soup to Nuts. It's Jerry Wallace walking up the stairs. In fact, it's Jerry Wallace, I believe, coming into the main lodge, walking up the stairs, spearing Jeff and Sandra, and knifing Lauren Marie Taylor.
Okay.
And she's on record for that. She even admits it's Jerry Wallace who did her kill.
Okay.
And that's it. And then Dash was brought on for the third act of the movie, the bulk of the performance. So I deal with that in chapter three of the book, as well as Ellen Lutter, who played the footsteps in the beginning, and also Carl Fulton, who also played Jason in all the kills that involved some special effects, where you saw the close up of his hands because he had to pull off the special effects, including the spear going down into Jeff and Sandra, and the knife going across the throat, the machete across the throat of Scott. So there's actually five people who played Jason, and I fleshed that out in great detail. I charted with graphics as to who killed who, and as well as the unknowns, because we don't know who killed Alice in the prologue. Nobody knows. The actors don't know.
Really?
There's no record. Yep. And we're not quite sure. You'll forgive me, I'm drawing a little bit of a blank here, but I think that there's some questions around Jack Marks or Deputy Winslow.
Huh.
But I fleshed that out and I chart it in the book by way of graphic under the ask and answered section of chapter three.
Some like that, I can't imagine they'd go through the trouble of making sure that Steve is back on set to ram a hammer through that guy's head. So I could see, like, anyone doing it. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, that kind of stuff I get, and that's fine. I mean...
And remember, this wasn't the Bible that they were filming.
Right,
so they
right.
weren't trying. They weren't trying to be particular to all the details. They didn't care. Hey, they needed somebody that could... I mean, Jerry Wallace was 5'8", or 5'7". Right? They just needed somebody that could put on the clothes that could fit, they weren't looking for a particular shape. They were looking for a warm body.
They wanted dirty hands and the plaid shirt.
Right, right.
Yeah, it worked out great. I mean, who on earth, even us crazy fans, we really could hardly tell at all, if at all. So why would a moviegoer tell, you know? So it's perfect. Now, me doing all this and asking all these questions and all this stuff, obviously you could see that people want to know something. So what part of the book are you most eager for fans to read? Like, what did you go, bam, at the end of the night and drop your pen and say, wow, I'm so, this is a great entry, I can't wait. Yeah. You know, what did you do that you did that?
Okay, so it really depends on what day of the week that you ask me, because I can think of a few things. And you know how I define each chapter, where there's a character analysis, then there's an interview with the actor, and then there's an ask and answer section, right? And that is pretty much the theme of every chapter in the book. There's 16 chapters, and that's the format of 14 of the chapters. 13 of the chapters. Ooh. And I think I loved telling the story of Jason. So you got to, if you're going to write a book about, you're going to write a definitive retrospective on Friday the 13th movie, you have to give the background of the killer.
Oh, I can't wait to see how you explained how he survived.
You know what? I think I did a winsome job. Now, don't get me wrong. I didn't camp out on some of this stuff. You know, you kind of move on. That was Ron Kurtz's attitude. He said there's certain things you just kind of gloss over, but I address it sometimes in detail and sometimes I just gloss over it. But that being said, I loved writing the story of Jason because I had never done it before. And I got to actually figure out what the canon was, being born in 1946, then 1957, his drowning, or his supposed drowning, then 1958, the killing of Claudette and Barry, and then the fires that in 19 and throughout the
60s was bad.
And 70s. Yep. Yeah, the water is the poison.
Wait, so you're
of the
telling
water
me that you went even that far?
Oh yeah, yeah. I start off. If I'm going to write a biography or a character analysis, I write the story of the character. Now, I didn't do that with like Jeff, Vicky, and Sandra because we don't know. That's never been in the canon before. But I did it with Jason
and his mother, I presume.
A little bit. Yeah, she's a big part of it. Right. And I talk a little bit about her husband and whatnot. And I talk about his, I even go back to Jason's birth and his deformity. So I took some liberties. You know, Paramount's not coming after me for it because most of it's canon. I just kind of cobbled it together and then I put it in narrative form with a little bit of dramatic flair. So that's one thing I'm excited for readers to learn or to read because I myself got excited writing it. The other thing that I kind of dug is on the ask, I answered, when I say the ask and answered section, it's a total of 31 narrative questions that I address. Something as easy as, hey, Paul said when their counselors were going into town for a night of drinking, 7 of the counselors were going, 6 were staying back. He said, hey, we only have 2 cars left. Why did he say that when there were actually 3 cars? That's an inane question, but I ask and answer that question, right? And then I get to something really serious, like the death of Mark in the wheelchair.
Right.
How on earth did he get a machete in his face and then all of a sudden go down a flight of stairs? Where did those stairs come from? And I actually map it out.
Yeah, they're there. Yeah.
They're there, but you can't see them. And there's a lot of, sometimes you think, oh, it's just camera tricks. And there is a little bit of camera tricks, but I like the fact that I fleshed it out from a scholastic standpoint. Put a chart in there with graphics, scene grabs, you know, and labeled them and whatnot, and made it cogent and discernible and decipherable for the inquiring mind. So that kind of stuff I'm excited for readers to look at as well. And then when it comes to interviews, I think, Bill Randolph is the best.
Oh, good. Wow.
He's just
him and Scott. They're my favorite characters in the movie.
Russell Todd's interview was really good, too, because of the cast of characters, I know Russell, Bill, Lauren Marie the best.
Oh, good.
And I mean, on a personal level. And so I remember talking to Russell, and he, too, is a fan of the movie. But here's the deal. He's a fan of his character, Scott. He thinks that Scott gets a bum deal. that he's a bit of a cad, and he goes, he is, but there's something charming about him. And if you watch the movie, there is, man.
No, there are. Oh, God. Yeah. I always liked him. And not even as like a horn dog. I mean, I even liked everything. You know, like you said, his charm, just the way he comes off, his playfulness, and then when he knows.
My only regret about Scott is if you watch the movie, the dude does not have a lot of screen time.
Yeah, I know.
I think he and I think, I mean, but the thing about it is the screen time that he does have, he owns.
Oh, yeah.
He owns, you know. So, yeah.
He has a lot of presence like Jeff Fahey to me. Like, when he's on screen, he gives that kind of fun guy vibe.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit because of the character that he plays. And of course, he was a good-looking dude, you know, still is, you know. And so, yeah, he commands the camera. I like it. I didn't pick this up until, like, the 100th time I watched the movie. But when he's in the lodge and he's looking at Terry on the couch with Muffin and Mark's arm wrestling, you know, that scene. He's standing up against the window and he makes his beeline towards Terry where he's going to ask her to dance. And he puts his collars up. And I'm like, dude, that is so 1981. And I just fall in love with the guy every time I see that, you know. So, yeah, I like Russell Tubb because he defends his character. He thinks his character is redeemable. Mm-hmm. He's not as much of a cad as people think that he is, you know, so forth.
Yeah, I interviewed him in, like, 2012, I'm going to say. Or 11. Okay. I think 11. And he was the nicest guy, man. We eventually re-aired that interview on this Skeleton Crew podcast. And just such a nice guy. But one thing I'm curious about, did you go as far as, because I think they kind of took the same scholastic approach as you did in this book on this game. Did you go to the Friday 13th game and walk through the map of Packanack Lodge level?
I have seen it, not the game, but I have seen the maps because I mentioned earlier at the beginning of our conversation that I like to build dioramas, right? And I'm actually in the process of doing some research for building a small diorama, an end table diorama of Packanack Lodge. And I've looked at some of the game footage and I'm having some of it 3D printed and I sent them to my 3D printer. Hey, this is what the main cabin's porch look like. And I send them the actual graphics from the game because the game is more clear.
Oh, it's so good.
Screenshots. So.
That game is like living the movie out. It's incredible, especially when you play it as Jason Part 2. It's just amazing. Really great.
Awesome.
So as far as this book, like when I was mentioning what type of approach you took, I was also hearkening back or thinking back to the obvious definitive at this point book for Friday the 13th, which does all of them.
Crystal Lake Memories.
So as far as that goes, would you say that you were still able to build on that and add a ton more of knowledge and information that they did not actually kind of go for when they were doing their thing?
Absolutely. Crystal Lake Memories, I consider to be the Bible of the franchise. But what you get with that is the 30,000-foot survey, a 30,000-foot view, a flyover view of each movie in the sequel or in the series. Otherwise, if they gave an in-depth retrospective on all 12 movies, you would have a volume of books and you would have a volume of DVDs. They couldn't do that. They wouldn't do
that. Right.
I did rely on – I tried not to, but I found myself relying on Crystal Lake Memories for some obscure quotes for some people who – just are not on record a lot.
Okay.
Like Steve Miner. Even though I met Steve Miner face to face, I met him before I was writing the book. Had I met him when I was writing the book, I would have badgered him with some certain questions, right? Steve Miner is an elusive interview. And I start each chapter with a quote from the principal character that I'm writing about, from the actor. And a couple chapters, I start with Steve Miner quotes. But I found that to be very helpful. But that's they just do a cursory overview. It's good. It's very good. And it's informative. And I cite it more than once, for sure. But it's not Crystal Lake Memories. That is, it's not exhaustive. I do consider this, while I'm not the best writer in the world, and I'm not the most, I'm not a 60-minute journalist by any stretch of the imagination. From a fan's perspective, who's got a few years under his belt, I do consider this to be an exhaustive treatment on what is one of the shortest, if not the shortest, movie in the series.
Wow.
And I think that you'd be hard-pressed to add much to it. You know, I'm sure certain things. I just found a behind the scenes picture.
Yeah, I saw you post that. Yeah.
Yeah. And Russell Todd, I don't know if you saw Russell Todd's response, but he goes, hey, I haven't seen this one either.
Wow.
40 years later, and he saw it for the first time. So there, that's always going to happen. You know, that's always going to happen. After I wrote the book, or I've written this book, I'm going to learn something new. But for the most part, this is about as exhaustive as it gets, at least I think. I will let you tell me where I'm wrong when you read it, because I do respect your opinion, and I know that any constructive criticism you have for me is going to come from a good place.
Right.
So I'll be open to it, because there will be a revision. You know, Bill Randolph, for example, wants me to include how the uncut footage or the cut footage was discovered. He played a key role in that. And I did not include that exhaustively in the book. I footnote it, and I leave it at as a footnote.
Wow.
But so I do plan on coming out with a revision, because somebody will come up with a misspelled word here, there, or an erroneous, maybe not a clear fact here. And I'll clean it up. But for the most part, I think this is about as exhaustive as you're going to get.
Right.
Crystal Lake Memories is excellent, but it is a 30,000-foot flyover survey.
Yeah.
And this is more than a survey.
Okay. Yeah, it's totally understandable. And, of course, you released this roughly on Friday the 13th. January, Friday, 13th, 2023.
Yeah, it was supposed to be released on Friday the 13th, and Amazon released it 2 days before.
Right, that's why I said roughly.
Yeah, and I was going to let it sit, but people started, I don't know, you know, once somebody posts it or something, you know, I'm like, okay, you know what, I'm not going to sit on this any longer.
Right.
So I just, you know, I let the cat out of the bag. So, yeah.
So what was the hardest thing about Friday the 13th Part 2 to write in this book, would you say?
Oh, I got four answers for you, and they're all the same.
Hmm.
Tom McBride, Jack Marks, Walt Gorney, and Marta Kober. It is really hard to write four in-depth chapters at length for three people who are dead,
right,
and one person who's completely elusive and recluse. And so it was, I had to interview Bill Randolph to get feedback about Marta, who I was supposed to meet in 2021 in Atlanta, but she was a no-show.
Right.
And I interviewed Bill about Marta, and I interviewed him about Jack Marks, and I interviewed him about Walt Gorney, because he is the principal actor who starred with all three of those. His scenes, yeah, he starred with, he's the,
oh,
guy,
yeah,
that's playing off
the telephone booth. Yeah,
yeah,
and then
exactly, Walt Gorney and him. Jack Marks, when they get apprehended, him and Sandra in the woods. So I had to rely on Bill Randolph to get back, and he was a hero in dusting off the memory and giving me stuff from which I could build on. There, I will admit, they're the shorter chapters in the book for obvious reasons, but they're not any less cheap.
Wow.
I bled over them. Tom McBride was by far the hardest. And that is because the guy died in 95.
Right.
Jack Marks, he died in 2021. Walt Gorney, 2004. Marta Kober, she's on record here, there, sporadically. But Tom McBride has no interviews, nothing on record.
Wow.
As it relates to his time on the set of Friday the 13th Part 2. There is an online or YouTube documentary on his life. Pretty much his sexual proclivities that led him led to his death.
Mm-hmm.
And I did rely on that a little bit. But I was able to deal with, you know, a few things from Lauren Marie Taylor, obviously, from previous interviews. And I think I did him justice. I did him justice. But again, that was the hardest thing to write about this book.
Right.
You have 16 chapters. I think you have something like 11 characters, four of whom are untenable. Three are dead, one's elusive. And I had to make it worth the reader's while to write about them.
To read each and every one of those, yeah.
Yeah, and not be fluff. I mean, serious stuff.
Right, right, right.
It, that's keeping with the rest of the book. So that was the hardest by far.
Now, this is a very selfish and ridiculous question from me. Did you... I know the answer is going to be, of course not. Did you happen to mention that...
I know where you're going.
That Vicky's character may have lived, as seen in Friday the 13th, Nine Lives.
9 lives. You know what? I did not. In fact, I'll talk to her about that tomorrow. But I got to give you a compliment, man. I have to give you a compliment. Because as I was writing this, the 16th and final chapter, you played an instrumental role. You provided me with some quotes and some thoughts on your recollections of the movie. You recall, right? Mm-hmm. And you didn't phone it in, by the way.
No.
I thought I hadn't heard from you for a few days, so I thought, well, I lost the guy. Okay, it is what it is, right?
Oh, no way.
No. You were obviously putting your thoughts down, and you were being very thoughtful in what you were going to say. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm putting your stuff down on paper, and you wrote me just you said some of the most beautiful stuff that just was great stuff, and just speaks to why how you and I are on the same wavelength about this movie. So I decided, well, you know, I got to give you a little bit of a biography as to why I'm even referencing you in this book, right? And so I wanted to go check out your fan flick. You might recall that I forgot the name of it. I said, hey, what's the name of your movie? I don't know if you remember that.
Right.
And freaking 1 million views, dude.
Yeah.
That's ungodly. That is incredible, dude. Congratulations on that.
And it's weird. I wasn't even doing that movie as, like, I want to join the Friday fan film brigade or whatever. Like, that's not what it was at all. I, if you watch my commentary on YouTube, you'll see how this movie came to be. And I think the only reason I even was willing to do anything is because in the back of my mind that other people have done it. So I was like, well, yeah, I guess I'll throw my hat in the ring. It wasn't really I didn't want to do it or anything like that. It wasn't like something I sought out to do or planned on doing or anything. This was simply taking pictures for my 5th anniversary and a guy dressing up as Jason, and we wanted to take him in Blairstown, and that's how the movie was born. So that
I remember the genesis of it, and I just want to tell your listeners right now, if they don't check out your death scene and
I know what you're gonna say.
And the cleaning up of your hair, they're missing out on something. They're missing out on something.
Yeah, this guy watched my movie, and the first thing he sends me is a screen cap of me fixing the hair around my ear before you
fall down. I freaking love it, man. I love it. That was hilarious.
He's like, wow, I'm glad you took the time to fix your hair before you died. I was like, yeah, well, you know, I just in case you end up, your ghost is the same exact hairstyle or whatever, I don't know. But
in all seriousness, though, congratulations, man, because I just want you to know that is an impressive feature, because there's a lot of fan films out there, man, and they're not clocking 7 numbers like that.
No, they're not, which is weird. I did start looking around to see if other ones did approach those numbers, and there's quite a few that don't, and that surprised me. So I was like, oh, wow, thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
So how long did it take you from the day you said, I'm going to write this book, until you put your final period and knew that you're pretty much done? You know, I'm sure you did some edits here and there, but like, what was that entire length?
Yeah, I'm going to give you the short answer, and then I'll flesh it out for afterwards. But it took me 5 months. I started in August. I got the idea in August. I put pen to paper in August, and I wrapped up in end of December. So I think that's about 5 months, give or take. The fastest I've ever written a book. But let me tell you, it took me 2 years of research. It's not something that I just put pen to paper and out came a book. I went to 3 conventions and befriended the cast, the surviving cast, got to know them on a personal level. I did my own research just as a means of building up the Facebook group Packanack Lodge. With no intent of writing a book, I wanted to have a daily segment that I could, you know, that would be interesting to fans. A daily segment of behind the scenes or trivia or fast facts, that kind of thing. And so after 2 years of that, I came to collect a lot of arcane and deep cut knowledge about the movie, most of which I think you probably already know. And so that took about 2 years to actually really put that kind of elbow grease in. And then once I decided to write it and put all of that knowledge down on paper, along with my personal experiences with the cast and crew, that it was 5 months. Yeah.
Hmm. Now you did hear our Banana Laser Friday 13th, like 2.5 hour long special.
Yep.
You saw the commentary we did, the video commentary?
I did. Yep. I listened to it. I listened to it.
Wow. And I guess I don't know if I ever sent you the first part two thing I did in 2012. I might have.
You sent me a lot of stuff, but one of the things that I really appreciated about some of the materials that you sent me and some of that I found on my own, I remember you were a guest on somebody's podcast, and it was about Friday the 13th Part 2.
Oh, Jerry Herring, yeah.
It could have been. You'll forgive me. I can't remember the particulars, but you came off as an apologist for the movie. Do you know what I mean by an apologist? A defender.
Yeah.
You know, and sorry, I didn't mean to talk down to you on that, but
usually that's not a good thing, but no, yeah, right. But sometimes you gotta defend, like, because I think that's why you wrote this book, because I feel like this movie should be held up there with the Halloweens and the Nightmare on Elm Street and the Texas Chainsaw, and it's not. So this book is sort of an apologist type thing to say, hey, hello.
That's right. This book is to give this movie street cred that it richly deserves. And so I'm listening to you on this podcast, and everybody was weighing in on this, that, and the other thing. And it was and you brought some chops to the podcast. I respect it when people do things with excellence. And you did that podcast with excellence. You were yourself. You were being you, but at the same time, you brought your A game. And I appreciate that kind of fandom. So you were a real inspiration for me when I was fleshing out Pack and Act Lodge as a Facebook group and getting it started. And you were one of the first people to join. I sent you an invite because I obviously knew of your passion for it. And so I wanted to thank you for that. So those materials that you sent me, if they're not regurgitated in the book, they're in my heart and in my brain. So thank you.
Cool. Yeah. You're saying this whole thing about my passion. You don't mean because I have a shrine and a Jason part two thing in my room, right? Oh, okay. Yeah. For anybody who doesn't know that, in my movie, you'll see little snippets of these things here and there, but I have my own Friday 2 shrine with body parts laying around it. I have a machete signed by Steve Dash laying on top of it, just like the one that was in the movie. I have a sculpt of the mom's head that was, you'll appreciate this, that's an actual sculpt from the movie prop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's identical to that, yeah. I think her name is Renee Brugman. She got hold of that and then produced a couple.
Yeah, that's right, because I think I reached out to you about that, or somebody, that's right, yeah. Okay, that's coming back to me. Yeah.
It's not cheap.
What's your wife, yeah, I bet. What's your wife think of your shrine?
You know, she never made a huge deal, but I think it's because she already knew my, I guess, eccentric things for passion or whatever. She's into horror also. So to her, this is not exactly crazy. And then when I moved into this house and I was able to start displaying a lot of the things I just had in closets in my 20s and mid-30s or early 30s, when I bought the house, I was able to put it out, and she was okay with that. She said, yeah, make a room with all your stuff. So I took that as, well, I could do whatever I want here.
You guys don't have kids, do you?
No.
Okay, all right. So you got that space. All
right. This house actually has 5 bedrooms, and we only use one of them. So the other one is like a big powder room for her with all her clothes and does all her stuff in there. One's a guest room. One is that room that I mentioned, and the other one is the one I'm sitting in right now, which is my studio podcast room.
All right, so you got a room for me and my wife when we come up to visit. I got you.
Yes, I did. I'll start heating that room now. Let me know where you're going.
Yeah, right.
It's like freezing in there. But yeah, so I have a Jason. I remember I contacted Steve Dash and I said, how tall are you? And he wrote back, yeah, because I tagged him in a Facebook thing, and he wrote back. I could have sworn he said 6 or 5'11". I guess, is he 5'11"? Is that what
he
said?
Yeah, he's 5'11", 175 pounds was the...
At the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the best I could do was a 6-foot-tall mannequin. And then I put a sack on him. I got the hillbilly clothes. He's all decked out, and he's right next to the shrine. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Do you want to hear a little secret? I'm going to follow your lead, because I know about your shrine. You've sent me pictures and video. And you know that I cosplay as Sackhead Jason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know that. And I don't have a mannequin. And I told my wife some of the royalties from this book, I'm going to get myself a mannequin. and I'm putting my stuff on display and taking it out. Yeah, so I'm going to be following your lead. And by the way, my research shows me they're mostly six-footers, so it is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is, yeah. Right, yeah, I wasn't going to go that far. I was like, listen, I'm not going to argue over an inch. So I said, this works. So So how did you recruit Bill Randolph, of course, who played Jeff in Friday 2, to forward this? I mean, from what you said already, I guess it's pretty obvious you two have grown pretty close in these times that since you've got to know the entire cast. So I guess...
Yeah, I should qualify that statement. I have an acquaintanceship with Amy Steele. I would never call her a drinking buddy. She's kind of there's three. Yeah, yeah.
So the bar's not going to fall down on you,
right? Yeah. <Okay. laughs> So Bill Randolph. So I met him in August of 2021 in Atlanta, Georgia, at the 40th anniversary of Friday the 13th Part 2 at the Days of the Dead, and that was where the entire cast, the surviving cast, was there, with the exception of Marta Kober, who regrettably was a no-show. And I volunteer for CNB Promotions, which handles the talent. So that means I collect the money that autograph seekers are paying, and I'm there to make the talent look good, you know, and move the line, get people in and out, and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And Bill Randolph was my favorite character and one of my favorite actors that I knew from afar. And I asked my manager, I said, put me with Bill. And sure enough, we clicked right away. And I tried not to be a fanboy, Alex. But that I couldn't. I had to ask him this question and that question. Was this an ad lib? And you know what? Let me tell you something about Bill Randolph. He will talk to anybody. There's nothing untouchable about him. There's no pretense. There's nothing disingenuous. He will talk to anybody, and when he does so, and the same thing for Russell Todd, by the way, you are the only person in the room.
Yep.
And a real class act. And so I asked him questions about this line and this action and this, and he, and so that laid the foundation. When I left Atlanta, you spend 3 days with these actors.
Right.
Because then I worked with Amy Steele for the remainder of the weekend. And you build a bond with them, and it's really cool. And I'm still a fanboy at heart. I still geek out that I got their text numbers, right?
Right.
I still geek. I mean, my wife looks at me like, and she just shakes her head. And because I'm like a kid on Christmas morning, and I say, Russell Todd just texted me. And she's like, that's like the 100th time. I go, I know, but he just did. That's a big deal to me. So I then met up with Bill again in Chicago. Again, it was the 40th anniversary reunion, and I was able to finagle it. And at that particular convention, I worked with Russell and Bill nonstop. We were right by each other.
Wow.
And that's when we really connected and got sentimental, and it was just a really good time. And then I met you in New Jersey at the Friday the 13th mini con.
Right. In Blairstown.
And you might recall that I was working with Bill there too.
Yep.
And by that time, our relationship had evolved from professional acquaintanceship to, you know, a couple of texts here and there, a couple of emails here and there, but I try not to overindulge, right?
Right.
And so we became a little closer. After that, I can't remember what happened, but I think I started writing my book, and I sent him a couple of questions, and I said, do you mind if we just talk? And that dude started calling me, started texting me. We did Zoom calls, and he was fantastic. And then we built up a rapport. And he loves to talk about Friday the 13th Part 2. If say what you will about that sequel, Bill Randolph, Lauren Marie Taylor, those two people are the greatest ambassadors for that movie, and Amy Steele. But she's in a different level. She's in a different sphere, right?
Right.
But Bill and Lauren Marie Taylor are incredible ambassadors for the movie. And he would talk forever if I didn't hang up the phone. And he was always giving of himself. And then we built up a rapport, and he had some great stories to tell. And so I just asked him, I said, Bill, would you be willing to write the foreword to the book? And he was so honored that I asked him, which, again, floored me. And it just took our relationship to the next level, which, as you know, I'm going to go to New York City at the end of the month. I'm going to have dinner with him and his wife. He's going to meet my wife. I'm going to have him sign autographed 40 plus books from customers.
Yeah, just put them on the table.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's right. And
right next to the bread.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So that's pretty much. So I asked him after a series of weekends working with him, where our relationship went from professional to acquaintance, or acquaintance to professional to personal. I felt comfortable to ask him, and then in the final stage of the book, when he was proofing it to write the foreword, we were communicating on a daily basis, and yeah, he's like a, I guess, a drinking buddy of mine now.
Wow.
And not really, but I feel that way, you know.
Wow. He's so a drinking buddy, even though he stayed behind with the rest of them.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I think that's the long answer to a relatively simple question. First of all, the simple question is, or simple answer is, I asked him. But the reason I asked him was because of the relationship that I had with him that has blossomed. And again, between you and me, and I'll deny this in a court of law, I'm still a freaking fanboy, man. I geek out when I get emails from these guys, when I get text messages from them, when I get to call them. You know, I'll always be a fanboy.
Yeah, it's like the rare text that you don't delete, right?
That's exactly right, man. That's exactly right.
Because like, now you have like six names on your phone that never, the texts never go away, but the rest do. Well, the one thing I did notice, so your name is Ron Gann, but your pen name is R.G. Henning. Now, I imagine your middle name is Henning?
That's right. You're so perceptive. Now, here's a throwback, Alex. You probably, do you remember when we first met on Facebook what my name was?
Yeah, it was weird. What the hell was it?
It was a Michael Keaton character from Night Shift. His name was Bill Jowski.
That's what it was, right?
Yeah. Yeah, my name is my real name is Ron Henning Gann, and this is actually my fourth book that I've written. The other three that I've written were academic books, more religious in nature. This particular book, because it's genre related, you know, my wife, unlike your wife, my wife is not into horror. Every time she goes to see a horror movie, I have to see two romantic comedies to make
Ooh.
Up. Yeah. She is not her cup of tea, but she's one of my biggest fans and my greatest supporter. So she's going to, right? So she's great in that regard. But she asked one favor of me when I was writing this book.
Hmm.
She just said, will you use a pen name?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, no problem. I'll use a pen name. So I use just a variant of my real name. Ron H. Gann is R.G. Henning. Or Ronald Henning Gann is R.G. Henning. You know, and it is what it is. So I made that concession to her just to, you know, she's not a fan of the genre, wants to protect my dignity, if you will. So there you have it.
Wow, yeah. Man. Well, great interview. And
thank you, buddy.
Yeah. And thank you for writing this. It's great. I carried the torch for this movie through podcasts for over 10 years on many shows I guested on. I always try to get that out there. I do it online, although it's my online days are coming to an end, but
sure.
it's just been so long, and I don't know if I get the same gratification as I used to. But then again, then I think of people like you, and I say, well, do I want to miss out on what if I were to think this 5 years ago, then
right.
I might not have ever met you. So there is reasons to not really commit to that. But and then I tried to incorporate it into my movie I made. I said I can't make a Friday the 13th movie without having a part two section in this movie. So I tried to homage Sackhead as best as I could in that movie with a cell phone and friends. and I got killed by him. So that was cool.
Well, so, let me just tell you, I appreciate your voice in the community and what you bring to the table, not only through your previous podcasts, and all that you have done with your buddies and championing part two.
Yeah.
But the way that you do it. And again, the contributions that you made to my book, and you'll read your stuff in chapter 16. I know I sent you excerpts of it.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks to your aptitude, to your fandom, and to the maturity of your fandom that I can so relate with. So I totally appreciate your voice, and I feel like I have a compatriot with you.
Yeah, definitely, man.
I appreciate your voice in the community and everything that you bring to the table. And by the way, I just wanted to throw this in because I forgot. When I was talking about my wife and the genre, You know what she said to me last night in the hot tub? My wife tells me in the hot tub, so you're going to do part three, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that too. Are we stopping at part two? Are you going to see the six? I imagine you're going to go by sales or whatever. Like, is it worth it to you to do this?
That's exactly it. Okay. It's not so much. It's It's not, I'm not, I didn't write it for money. It's more or less how many people are going to read it, you know? And that's where, and you know, the way my publisher, Amazon, does it, I get to see that. So, so far I've been encouraged by it. So, because I would like to do part three, I would like to do part four as well, but it's definitely done better than I expected. And it's been received better than I expected. However, that's by a lot of the fans in the community who like me, such as yourself. There's going to be those haters that are probably going to rear their heads. I am looking forward to your review, be it public or private, because I respect your opinion and I respect the heart from which you come. So.
Thank you, man. You too. Yeah.
Thank you for your time, man.
Yep. Thank you, guys. So go out there.
Amazon.com. Sackhead Jason. Or no, Sackhead. The Definitive Retrospective on Friday the 13th, Part 2. Or you can do a search under R.G. Henning. Whatever.
Right. And don't forget, guys, Amazon.com is that place where you buy books. I don't know if you heard of it. They sell books. So I heard other things, too, if I'm not mistaken. But, yeah, I think Amazon.com is the thing that sells books. So there you go. That's the best place to get it. Yes. Happy belated Friday the 13th.
Yep.
And once again, thanks again, Ron.
Later.
See you later.